Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, episode 157 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg Everett is in the house. Dude, what's going on?
Not much. Just getting ready to podcast the shit out of this podcast.
Woohoo! Sweet.
Yeah. So how you feeling?
super good. I've been up since 3 a.m. So this is going to be a good time. We did some sort of a video deal similar to Eat Time, if anybody's ever tracked that down. But a little bit more professionally done, and we didn't almost get arrested in the store. So Specialty Health is going to have that up for free on their website here in a couple of weeks. Did a couple of podcasts with some other cats wanting to pick my brain on paleo-related stuff for some darn reason. And then you were waiting in the wings for us to knock out the beginning of year four.
Yeah. So, year four.
Or is it year three? Are we fleshing out year three? I guess we just started year three.
We just finished year three.
Did we finish it? Okay. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Right? Okay.
Yes, we're starting year four.
Okay.
Either way.
So what's new with you?
Not much. Doing a little practice weightlifting meet here for the team in preparation for the American Open tomorrow. Been hanging out with my buddy Mike, San Diego, for the last couple days, doing a little training, doing some T-bar rows, and that's pretty much it.
I haven't done T-bar rows in ages, since the late 80s, early 90s,
when I got to train at Gold's Gym in high school.
Seriously?
So I'm pretty much going to be T-bar rowing about 300 reps a day for the next couple months until I get sick of it.
Sweet.
Yep. Fantastic.
Those were always cool because even if you were a skinny puke, you could load up a ton of weight on it and look like you were kind of jacked. So,
yeah, exactly. Oh, dude, I leg pressed like 12 plates, bro. Yeah, it's at a 45-degree angle and very well lubricated.
Yeah, details.
All right. The joy.
Should we get down to a cute? Evolve Foods show sponsor.
Oh my god.
Evolvefoods.com. Go get some chow. We've got a grass-fed whey protein for sale. Snacks galore. Jerky, cookies, almond meal cookies. It's all amazing. Wolfpack 12, I think, still gets you a 15% discount if you
you'll find
the discount code. It may have expired by now. I don't know. They never tell me these things. We'll have another show sponsor here in a couple of weeks. We'll roll that one out here soon. How's your book doing? How's Takano selling?
Good. It's doing well. It's so far, it's on schedule, so we should have that thing by the release date of December 1st. And all the reviewers who have gotten pre-release copies have really liked it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Sweet. And then remind people about your ebook that has an ungodly amount of programming in it.
Oh, yeah. So we just have we just put out the Catalyst Athletics Book of Programs, which is this little ebook collection of training cycles. I think there's 20 of them in there. So that's probably about 5 or 6 years worth of training cycles right there. You never have to think again. And that's only $10.
$10 skinny dollars. And since people have an attention span of about 5 days, then that really is a lifetime of training.
It is. Absolutely. So
perfect.
All right. Let's talk about pancreatitis.
Indeed.
And the aftermath of. Okay, Jordan says, "Hi, Rob. I'd love to hear your thoughts on a few questions I have about recovering from an acute pancreatitis attack. Most conventional information out there states that a low-fat diet is the way to recover, that a pure liquid diet is recommended for the immediate days after the incident, and then to slowly introduce rice, whole grains, etc., and then eventually move on to a vegetarian/vegan diet, with an emphasis on no red meat, no bacon, pork, etc." Yes, that would be vegetarian. "I'm sort of at a loss on direction to go. I've read your horror stories about following different diets, including vegetarian, and have seen the paleo results work. However, I understand that when the pancreas has been compromised, things may have to be done differently. I understand how a low-fat diet contributes to recovery as the pancreas doesn't work as hard, but at the same time, eating inflammatory foods such as rice and grains certainly can't help either. I'd really love your opinion or any knowledge you'd have or care to share. Smiley face."
I think the clear answer to this is a 12-block zone diet. and that will fix
with Big
everything.
Macs and Coors Light,
exactly,
and then a few almonds to balance it out.
Exactly. So this is I have some research that I could throw out here to support this stuff, but I'm this is Rob's opinion based on the research that I've dug around. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But in my opinion, it really seems like pancreatitis flares seem to be heavily tied in with gluten consumption. So, you know, that's just a thing to kind of keep in mind. And then the other part of this is that I don't say it enough, need to say it more. I'm really macronutrient agnostic on this stuff. So if you feel like, you know, for a particular situation, you would do better on higher fat or lower fat, you can easily modify things to work that way. So you could consume a low protein, low fat, higher carb, paleo, you know, interpretation, and that would be completely kosher, and it might be 100% the appropriate thing for you to do for recovery after a pancreatitis flare. I'm inferring from the way that you've worded things, the way that Jordan worded this stuff, that, and I'm assuming Jordan is a she. If you're a he, I'm sorry. I'm sure I'll mess something up later, and it will balance out in the cosmic balance sheet. But I'm assuming that you're not grain free, and I really am of the opinion, other than like some bacterial infection, you know, like food poisoning type things can also cause a pancreatitis flare. But I really think that it's probably a gluten exposure or something like that that probably causes this thing. So it seems smart to probably go at the minimum, go gluten free. I would say probably grain free, you know, follow the rest of the parameters that the docs are laying out here, and then see where you go from there. Like if the pancreas is not inflamed from whatever is irritating it, then you should have normal function and you should be able to eat a little higher fat and not have a problem with that. But if that's not the case, you can always modify the fat lower. But I still see a pretty strong argument for removing these foods that really seem like they are problematic with pancreatitis flares.
All right. I like it. Okay. Do body types determine diet and exercise? Andrew says, hey, guys, love the podcast and appreciate your commitment to providing quality information for free. I don't know how you got that impression, Andrew.
See,
I can't even get your
accident.
Name right. my question is about body types. I only recently learned about the whole ecto-endo-mesomorph thing. I know, I'm slow. I'm wondering what the implications are for how these different body types should approach their diet and training. What changes, if any, are there between the three? I'm a 33-year-old male, 6 foot, and in the last 3 years have gone from 165 kilos to 115 kilos through training BJJ and a variety of supplemental strength and conditioning. I've been doing the paleo thing for the last 6 months and have certainly seen the benefits, dropping the most weight and getting fitter and faster for jiu-jitsu like never before. Just wondering what I can take into account to take care of that last 10 to 15 kilos. Sorry for the long question and hope you haven't covered this topic before. If you use my question in the podcast, can you let me know, please, as I'm starting at the beginning and I'm only up to episode 22. See, I told you I love your podcast. Much love from Australia. Yeah, Andrew, I'm letting you know right now we're using your question. We'll see. We'll see you in 130 episodes.
I'm going to email Squatchy so that he can ping this guy and let him know. What are your thoughts on the meso endo ectomorph gig?
Well, basically, if you're an ectomorph, you can pretty much eat whatever you want, and nothing's going to change. If you're a mesomorph, you can pretty much eat whatever you want, and you're still going to be big and jacked. And if you're an endomorph, you're probably always going to be a little bit chubby, no matter what you do. So maybe that's the really cynical perspective on the whole thing, but that would be my really broad strokes opinion on that deal. So yeah. I guess I would say that maybe the way you would change it is that you, assuming this guy is saying that he's an endomorph because was 165 kilos, which is a big boy, he's probably going to have to tighten up the belt quite a bit more than his ecto and meso counterparts. And he may have to be a lot more cautious with the carbs and and you know, even food timing and liquid food and all these different things that these other guys might be able to get away with a little more freely. But Rob, you're the expert. You tell me.
No, I was hoping you were going to save me on this. But
I tried.
I agree. Like, I actually really, really like that answer. Like, I was trying to think if there was something bogus to this. But, you know, I think about some of the classic mesomorphs that I've run across, like John Fregoso and folks like that. And it's like...
He could live on Twinkies. And he would still look
has.
Like that.
Like, yeah. He's eaten horribly, and he's, like, super strong, super jacked. He eats really well, and he gets stronger and more jacked. But, you know, I mean, in the spectrum of things, you know, I think I run a little on the ecto-endo thing. So I get the, like, the double ugly stick slap on all that stuff. And, definitely for me, particularly over the past couple of years with stress and sleep deprivation and everything, I just need to watch things way more closely, I feel like, than some of the people who are kind of classic mesomorphs. So, it sounds like Greg said, that you're probably in this kind of endomorph kind of gig, and you might need to do a little more cardio if you're not getting enough sleep. That could be an issue. You know, it's kind of just take all of the standard, you know, things that we're thinking about with body composition, activity level, sleep, carbohydrate intake, any type of like pro-inflammatory kind of situation. And you're just going to have to look even more closely at that and probably be even tighter to get stuff down to a lower level, or you just go on enough gear so that end up creating a mesomorphic hormonal environment, and then everything's cool. So
aftermarket mesomorph.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. This, I don't even know where to begin on this one. So Rob, you're going to have to save me on it. Oh, it's addressed to you. Perfect. Is squatting below 90 bad for the knee joint? Rob says, hi guys. Thanks for what you do. Oh, damn it. It's not addressed to you. That's his name. I travel for work throughout Northern California and have all the time in the world to listen to your podcast. I enjoy listening and learning. Thanks to you, I've been following a paleo lifestyle for the last 2 years and have lost 30 pounds. I look, feel, and perform way better than ever in my ever before in my life. This is from somebody who lives in Tahoe and gets to ski 100 plus days a year. The same with my bikes. Also, I'm an avid CrossFitter and CrossFit at CrossFit Avalanche in Tahoe Vista, California. Coaches Travis and Miles are great, and their programming is not what I've heard referred to as a dick measuring contest. That would result in a lot of lawsuits, I'm sure. unfortunately, I suffered a bad fall while riding my mountain bike on August 1st and have recently had ACL reconstruction surgery and major repair to both my meniscuses. Each version in this thing. It's pretty good. While I'm going through the rehab process, I've had the, quote, opportunity to listen and learn from my surgeon, physical therapist, chiropractor, and acupuncturist. My question regards squatting below 90 degrees. My PT says it's tough on the knee and menisci, and the joint isn't really built for that, let alone while heavily weighted. It even goes so far as to say that very few walks of life require squats that deep, just serious weightlifters and baseball catchers. I asked my surgeon the same question. His response was something along the lines of risk versus reward. In other words, you can go below 90 and the knee menisci can handle it, but years of deep squats will take their toll. So what gives? Is squatting below 90 degrees more of a competition standard, or is it good for the knee? I've never had knee issues before, have a decent back squat at 315 pounds, and, quote, enjoy pistols. Are these movements in my past, or can I look forward to getting back to my normal routine? Again, thanks for what you do, Rob.
Greg, what do you think?
God damn it, I knew you were going to say that. You know, this is one of these discussions that is never going to go away. No one's ever going to have the right answer. And we're going to be talking about this until we're 4,000 years old and can't squat below 90. I mean, obviously, the ACL reconstruction, it makes this a whole different story for you personally. And that's something you're going to have to definitely kind of work through with your surgeon, with your PT, with your chiro, possibly even your acupuncturist. I'm not sure what he's going to contribute to the knee thing. But I'm not as open-minded as Rob is when it comes to orthopedic acupuncture.
I'm thinking he's going
to
contribute a needle.
So I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with squatting below 90 degrees. And to hear someone say that that's not what that joint is meant for, like, what do you mean? What else is it meant for if not to bend? If it was not meant to bend that far, then it wouldn't bend that far. And maybe I'm just stupid and simple, and I don't understand these advanced concepts of physical therapy and not using your joints through their full ranges of motion. But that just seems fundamentally like nonsense to me. The issue is, are you doing it with dysfunction or not? And so that's the big problem is that all, you know, you talk to an orthopedic surgeon about it, whether or not squatting is bad for the knees. Of course they're going to say yes, because look at their patients. All their patients have fudged themselves up doing squats. So you look at that and you say, wow, squats must be really bad for the knees. But they don't get to see all the people who squat, you know, multiple times a week, very heavy for years and years and years, not decades, and have no problems at all because they're not in their offices. So I think again, you have to say that squatting as a whole is, a safe movement, but you have to have, you know, consider the caveat that that means you have the requisite mobility, you have the proper muscular development to support that movement. You have proper programming, to ensure that you are progressing over time, you're building and not, breaking down. And that you're not an idiot and you're not, you know, working through horrible pain and dysfunction for years at a time. Because in that case, you are going to be grinding down your knees and hurting yourself and probably blowing out your hip, your back, your ankles, and your neck and your shoulders in addition. So, you know, I don't know what to tell this guy, honestly, other than, you know, make sure you consult with your various medical professionals and be smart about it. But I would definitely not write off squatting for the rest of your life.
It especially when you've got a person who's active and probably not going to cease being active. And it seems like if there's any situation in which a joint or you know structure is going to get damaged, it's when we wantonly ignore a certain range of movement. And then at some point down the road, and particularly, so we've got a skier slash mountain biker, when could we potentially imagine some sort of dynamic loading past 90 degrees? And if we've never done that, you know, what type of neurological stability do we have? What type of muscular and joint stability do we have? I mean, it seems like there should be some reasonable, you know, loading protocol. Again, like Greg said, within the confines of smart prehab, rehab, and everything, but we should be able to get things strong and rewired so that this thing is immunized and maybe a little bit bulletproof, and instead of just leaving a gaping, you know, hole in the armor. Let's say like maybe he's classically done more of an Oli style squat that maybe puts a little more force on the patella tendon and stuff like that. You could also shift the emphasis a little bit more, glute and hamstrings, pushing the hips back a little bit more, but still go a full range or relatively full range of movement, but also just change the loading a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. There's always ways to kind of work around it and modify it in a manner that would be maximally protective and minimally damaging. But Mike over here just kind of made a good point, scribbling on a piece of paper, and said, skiing is going to be way worse than squatting below 90.
Right.
And that does bring up an interesting point about squatting in particular, though, is that, you know, so many of these docs and PTs are saying, you know, squat only to parallel to 90. And anyone who's gotten in trouble and had to do wall sits at 90 degrees, man, if you don't get that, that's probably the worst possible position to arrest that downward force and change directions, then I don't know if we can help you. I think, and don't quote me on this because I don't really follow the research that closely, but I think it's pretty common knowledge that that's the position in which there is the most stress on the knee. And I think the forces on the patellar tendon and all that are the highest, and Mike's kind of nodding his head. And so I think that's probably about right. And so the idea is that going below parallel, you actually get a little more contribution from the posterior chain. changing direction, and you can actually absorb that force a little better rather than having so much strain in that one location that you're actually trying to protect. So, you know, again, this is one of those discussions that no one's ever going to win. I'm going to continue squatting all the way down. We did a seminar in here, a weightlifting seminar, of course, a couple weeks ago. I had a girl with no ACLs squatting. Granted, she wouldn't sit to absolute rock bottom, but she's below parallel. And, she's perfectly fine. She loved it. And that's how she's been squatting. That's how she plans to continue squatting. So, again, it's a decision you have to make for yourself, and you got to make it with make as educated as a decision as you can and continue reevaluating through the months and years. But don't write it off completely yet.
It just seems kind of goofy that, you know, you wouldn't develop like an air squat, maybe some walking lunges that move you through that full range of movement, and then just slowly, progressively load those movements. Like I'm just kind of at a loss that there wouldn't be both safety and some benefit in doing all that.
Yeah. It's not like you go back tomorrow and you load that 315 on the bar and, you know, do a bunch of bouncing off your calves type squats. But yeah, over the long term, you should absolutely be able to break back into that. So, and again, if you're going to be going downhill skiing, like you're going to be screwing yourself up anyway. And if you're not actively strengthening the muscles around the knees, then you're just asking to blow those things out. So what did Eva have, like 8 or 9 knee surgeries throughout the course of her career? I mean,
yeah,
that's skiing for you.
And she's still a big fan of squatting.
Exactly. Oh, I mean, look at the pro skiers, Olympic skiers. Those guys squat their faces off, and they are strong as hell because they have to be. There's no way you can support that stuff without that strength. So, okay. Olympic lifting and speed through the elbows. I prefer speed through the nose.
Or pick Kurt, line.
Yeah, the pick line is even better. Kurt says, hey guys, my question is for Greg today. Rob, you've already helped me out enormously with my diet, and now I need someone to unfuck my flexibility and technique. I'll see what I can do. My problem is this. I have a power clean of 115 kilos, a squat snatch of 100 kilos, similar to a snatch, but only have a squat clean of 105 kilos, 5'9" and 85 kilos. I know that the main issue is it's speed through the elbows when catching in the squat position, and also that my arms don't get parallel with the ground, forcing me to kiss the ground. My question is, I want to look at possibly competing, and that is I wanna, WANNA, for those of you who are curious, at competing in some Oli comps one day because I really enjoy it, but obviously suck at it. So what can I do to improve the flexibility and speed issues to help me out? I used to do a bit of bodybuilding, and that has obviously made me a lot tighter in areas I don't want to be tight. I do CrossFit gymnastics nowadays, but want to mainly focus on the Oli lifting and still incorporate some gymnastics, because who doesn't love being upside down? Huh. Any assistance you could give me would be awesome. Cheers, mate. I wonder if he's from Australia, because he just called me mate, so he should be used to being upside down. You're on the bottom of the earth.
Seriously.
All right, so first of all, it's really remarkably common for people to power clean more than they clean in the CrossFit land or outside the Olympic weightlifting world, largely because there are a dearth of heavy squats and a surplus of power movements. And so, of course, you're going to excel at the things you practice and not the things that you don't. So part of it, you don't mention how much you front squat, which would be helpful to know. Because I've seen people who power clean more than they front squat also, which is a really big sign that they need to be squatting more. So that's number one, is make sure you're pushing those squats. And, you should be able to front squat like a minimum of about 105% of your best clean. And so if you're, probably power clean between 80 and 90% of your best clean, kind of depending on your style and what your particular strength and weaknesses are. So you should definitely be doing more than 105. But in any case, assuming it's not a strength problem, assuming you have a huge squat and you're fine, the flexibility may be kind of an issue, but if you can rack 115 power clean, there's no reason you can't do it in a squat, unless you're horribly inflexible in the lower body. You should still be able to support it. So what I would tell you for now is more squats, less power cleans, more cleans. And when you're doing your cleans, just power clean it and then squat it. Because if you can power clean 10 kilos more than you can clean, you can rack all your cleans very high in a power receiving position and then just continue into that squat, which is, in my opinion, what you should be doing anyway. You never want to jump into the bottom of the squat and drop the bar on yourself. And that could be part of it too, is that you're trying to get too far under the bar. It's crashing on you. And, with less than perfect flexibility and possibly a not really well-developed front squat, that's making it impossible for you to actually stand up with it.
Greg, could this be an over-gripping the bar deal too?
Yeah, it could, which is a good point. A lot of people, when they power clean, just choke the bar all the way up. And yeah, for all we know, he's not even racking it completely. He could be just pretty much holding it in his arms and with a little friction on the sternum. In his power cleans, which means that when he tries to clean it, yeah, those elbows are going to be pretty much straight down, and that's not going to work. So, yeah, make sure you are, even if you power clean, even if you don't feel like you have to, that you are racking it 100% on the shoulders. And remember, your upper arms don't need to be parallel with the ground to rack a bar. You know, I have a lifter in here, Kara, who all of her cleans, she can maintain a full grip on the bar. Her elbows are practically pointing straight down, and she has a very strong rack position. I've never seen her miss a clean due to not racking it. So it really depends on how you're built, in particular kind of your relative upper arm and lower arm lengths, and your flexibility and all that. The main thing is that you need to have your shoulders forward and a little bit up to create a space for that bar to rest behind the peak of the shoulders, so between the peak of the shoulders and your throat. But yeah, make sure you're practicing that with all your front squats, and that same front squat rack position that you're using should be where you end up when you clean and power clean. And then to work on actual speed, if that's what it is, speed with the elbows, doing stuff like tall cleans or high hang cleans or cleans from high blocks, or doing a complex of a power clean plus a clean, or power clean and then squat it and then a clean. All that stuff can help a lot. You can even do muscle cleans, probably from the hang, just to practice the mechanics. Make sure you're pulling your elbows really high into the sides before you turn the arms over, rather than trying to reverse curl it with your arms at your elbows at your sides. But again, you know, this is one of those questions where you gave us about, you know, 5% of the info that would really... we would need to totally square away your little red wagon. You know, post a video on our forum and you can get some really more dialed in feedback on this for sure.
Cool.
Any thoughts on that, Rob?
No, I mean the main, yeah, seriously. I mean the main thing that popped into my head is the potential of the hands being maybe a little narrow and or over gripping the bar. And I mean, all the other stuff you mentioned, like the disparity between power clean being greater than the front squat, and so just not being comfortable getting under the bar and stuff like that. Like, that all totally makes sense. But I've definitely seen folks, when I think about folks getting folded forward, kind of two things. One, like Greg said, folks over pulling the bar goes higher than what you would really want in a way, and then it crashes down, folding the person forward. Or if you're gripping the bar very heavy or tightly, then it's going to drive the elbows down, and it kind of breaks that thoracic spinal position and will allow you to fold forward.
Yeah, which, you know, I glossed right over that part. He says he's kissing the ground, which I guess could be interpreted as falling forward, like you just kind of described. In which case, he could just have a terrible pull right off the ground. I mean, pretty much anywhere from between the ground and when it's on the shoulders, he could be shifting forward or doing something improperly. Mm. And so basically jumping in under the bar, when with a power clean, you can there's a lot bigger margin for error there. You can kind of run around with it and get a little weird, jump forward to get under it. But with a clean, it's going to be tougher to do. So again, it's pretty much impossible to really answer that question well without knowing exactly what's happening.
Sweet.
Yeah. Okay. Russell says, hey, Rob and Greg, I'm a 48-year-old healthy male who has been paleo with raw dairy, recently cut this, for 4 years, lifting twice per week, full body workouts with heavier training in winter and lighter in summer. Recently, I was diagnosed with shoulder calcification. Wasn't bad at first and thought it was a pulled muscle. 2 months later, and the pain was intense with no range of movement. Saw a sports doc, got a shot, and now doing PT for a resulting frozen shoulder. Not fun to say the least. So my question, what causes this? To my knowledge, I was living the dream of health and all my friends were having a good time drinking their scotch and telling me I should have stayed on the dark side. What gives? Should I give up and join Satan? Actually, it's join Satin. Or will I get better to lift again? Cheers, and thanks for all your great work and humble way to present your info. Written on iPhone on a Japanese train, so apologize for any strange wording.
That's got to be a first, or at least to our knowledge. You know, my understanding of frozen shoulder is it's more of a neuro thing, neuromuscular, but the nervous system is interpreting some sort of a damage state, some sort of a weakness, and it literally just kind of locks things up. And so like some ART, I think we've got a question later actually about different physical modalities, but you know, some soft tissue work combined with convincing the neurological system that the normal range of movement is okay is kind of the prescription here. So, you know, if you were eating a more inflammatory diet, then I might hang some weight on that, but it sounds like you've been eating well, so I would hang most of this on some sort of a neuromuscular imbalance, maybe not enough scapular retraction work, maybe too much chinning and benching and not enough, you know, like dumbbell rows, bent rows, ring rows, that sort of gig. Again, without being able to see movement and do a little bit of an assessment, then this stuff is kind of stabbing in the dark at best. But I would hang more of the cause as being kind of a neuromuscular gig versus, you know, like systemic inflammation.
Yeah. Mike says, go back to the ortho. Shouldn't have gotten frozen shoulder in the first place.
There you go.
But yeah, I don't have a much of a background in this stuff, but my understanding of frozen shoulder is that it is, you know, neurological, and it's more like a body sensing a kind of a weakness, and it just won't let you move, kind of locks down. So hopefully the PT is addressing that directly and not just saying don't use your shoulder.
Or go to Chico and wait on the 3-month waiting list to get into John Fragoso.
There you go. Yikes. Okay. I can already tell I'm going to struggle to read this one. Chronic pain, NMT, knowledge bombs on JRE podcast. Daniel says, Rob, thanks for all the awesome info. You killed it on the JRE podcast. Best one I have heard yet. What's JRE podcast?
Joe Rogan Experience.
That was a pretty interesting experience.
Getting high and then drinking 16 ounces of vodka. Definitely improved.
Good and tight.
Yeah.
Wondering what you think about chronic soft tissue pain. Have had the same nagging injury for over a year. Tried acupuncture, various different physio methodologies. Wondering what you think about NMT, neuromuscular as opposed to fascial manipulation and other techniques. Also, have you heard of Thomas Greiner and Neurosoma? Thoughts? Thanks a butch. I appreciate all the knowledge.
Thanks a butch.
Buuch.
So I am not familiar with Greiner and the Neurosoma. I did a little reading on it, but I'm really hesitant to comment on modalities like this that I haven't really experienced myself. I've had huge success with ART, active release technique, which addresses soft tissue mobilization, breaking up scar tissue, and also in conjunction with all this stuff, it's moving the joint and the muscles through their normal range of movement. And so you're tackling everything that you want all in one shot, at least so the theory goes. You know, you're getting the neurological reintegration because you're moving, say, like an impinged shoulder due to tight pec minor, tight lats, tight teres and all that. You're moving everything through the normal range of movement, breaking up scar tissue, and kind of convincing the nervous system that what you're doing is okay, that this is safe, that it doesn't need to be overly active or impinged to protect something. And I forget who I was talking to, whether it was Starrett or John Fragoso or who it was. But, you know, they were of the opinion that all of these modalities have kind of a bell curve or like a normal distribution of efficacy. Like certain people, it works phenomenally on them every day, all the time. You move out a standard deviation and it works on those same people some of the time for some things, and then other people it never addresses or touches any of this stuff. And like you have myofascial release, which is really, really popular in the chronic fatigue fibromyalgia scene because it's really gentle. And like with these chronic fatigue fibromyalgia people, they're so inflamed and effed up that if you were to do ART on them, they would be bruised and so inflamed from the treatment that they would probably not come back just because it would hurt so bad. So I think that there's a lot of cool stuff. There's like Graston and where they actually use these tools. It looks like they're getting ready to dismember a body with this stuff. It's like stainless steel tools that they get in there and start tinkering on things. But I think that there's a lot of effective soft tissue modalities. I don't think any of them work on everybody. I think you have to get in and kind of play with it and see how you respond. For me, pretty hard ART works like magic. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts on that stuff is that, and perhaps I'm spoiled at this point because my Cairo is like some kind of wizard from outer space. She's amazing. You saying that you are just a fascial manipulation person, or you're just a neurosoma person, or you're just a activator, Cairo, whatever. It's like saying you're a carpenter, but you only use a hammer. You know what I mean? Like if you really want to get in there and, do work on people, like you've got to have a range of skills and experience. My Cairo goes in. Yeah, she does adjustments, all the, conventional kind of adjustment stuff, but she does all kinds of soft tissue manipulation. And basically it's the use what works sort of approach, rather than saying like, this is my methodology, this is what I do. Maybe that's, again, is expecting too much from people, but, the information's out there, and a lot of these practitioners are really, really committed to continuing to learn and just get more and more tools for that toolbox and do whatever it takes to get their patients better. Maybe that's a little idealistic, but I have high
continuing
expectations.
Continuing and trying to improve yourself, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yet another vitamin D question. Fun with Meat says, hello, gifted gabbers/ramblers. I'm a little confused about vitamin D after reading the following interview with Morley Robbins, a.k.a. Magnesium Man. And there's a link here to monthlyaspectarian.com. I'm trying to get my head around it, but I think he's saying that the body may be keeping vitamin D levels low to prevent excess calcium being stored around the body. Something to do with calcitonin? I would love to know your thoughts on this. Vitamin D seems to have so many benefits, but it also seems strange to me that so many people have low levels even when they're getting sufficient sunshine. P.S. Loving the podcast down in New Zealand. I got dragged along to my first CrossFit session the other night and almost died after the warm-up. I think I will stick to lifting logs and our 16-month-old daughter on the beach for now. Thanks heaps. Good plan.
Good call. I was just in an email thread with Chris Kresser, Matt Lalonde, Chris Masterjohn, Stefan Guionet, and we were talking about some polymorphisms in calcitonin, activity, vitamin D status, and it was really interesting. And the takeaway that I got from all that, and I think that Stefan Guionet is going to do a article on this soon, so keep your eyes open for that. But the basic takeaway is that there are polymorphisms that people who are of genetic ancestry from higher latitudes tend to have the same response with regards to vitamin D activity. They respond the same at lower levels. So if you have a genetic ancestry that is more equatorial, then we would see this more classic kind of hunter-gatherer, Hadza, Maasai, pretty high vitamin D levels would be what we would consider normal for those folks. For people like me who are, you know, Scandinavian and Scottish, we can probably get by on lower vitamin D levels and have the same efficacy. And this is some pretty new stuff for me, but it definitely makes sense, and it's a reasonably new area, but I like what this guy was talking about with all this stuff, and I think it makes sense, and it's another example that we unfortunately or unfortunately can't just throw out a one-size-fits-all. Like, even for me, historically, I've recommended that folks be in that like 60 to 70 nanograms per deciliter level, and that for even somebody of my ancestry may actually be too high. Like, I may be better served being more in that 40 to 50 level, maybe plenty, and actually pushing up into the 60 to 70 level could actually cause some calcium storage problems. So that it's we can continue to learn, that's for sure.
You mean continue to learn and get better? Amazing.
Hopefully. You know, the funny thing, though, not to digress on this too much, is that do I even want to go down this shirt? What the hell? It's funny that there is a subsect of folks out in the interwebs that if you come out and you make your best educated statement about protein intake or vitamin D levels or whatever, and then new information comes along and you're like, oh, I need to modify my position on this. I remember there was a big brouhaha on Paleo Hacks because I changed my position on something, and some folks on there were like, well, how can we really trust anything that Rob has said? Because, you know, he keeps changing his position on stuff. And so it's kind of this, like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like, if you, it in a way, it just encourages you to just, like, hunker in and be like, nah, 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 you know, I'm not going to learn anything new, because you're going to get kicked in the balls no matter what you do. So it's kind of ironic. I'm sure there will be some sort of gnashing of teeth or backlash over the fact that I'm like, well, maybe we need to look a little bit more at specific equatorial, you know, latitudinal genetics, and then we can better dial in what your optimum vitamin D levels are, instead of there being, you know, just simply looking at equatorial hunter-gatherers. That may not be the best extrapolation that we can make for everybody.
Well, anyone who doesn't understand that conceptually, you're going to be fighting with over anything anyway. You say anyway.
Yeah.
So, fuck 'em.
Bugger it.
Yeah. Okay. Irene says, hi, Rob. I've been an avid listener for some time and have learned a great deal from you. Thank you. I finally have a question to submit. My friend's daughter was recently hospitalized and diagnosed with Guillain-Barre syndrome. Her daughter has difficulty breathing and has lost some function of her facial muscles. It will take intensive therapy for her to recover. The symptom, I don't know what
syndrome
is. I think she's saying to say the symptoms is an autoimmune illness. I would like to recommend to my friend that she try a paleo approach when her daughter is able to eat properly again. Would a paleo approach be helpful to treat this sort of illness? Do you have any literature or success stories I can share with my friend which may help convince her to try it out? Thank you in advance for any recommendations or ideas you can provide.
You know, it was maybe 50 podcasts back, maybe more, we had a question on this. And, you know, it's the same deal. Any autoimmune condition, I think, is fair game for trying an autoimmune paleo approach. And then right after I said, maybe we need to do lower vitamin D levels in folks, interestingly, the caveat on that, in talking to Chris Kresser, he has noticed that his folks who have autoimmune condition, even if they are of Northern European ancestry, they seem to benefit from quite high vitamin D levels. Like, you see a resolution. It's like the diet has helped, sleep has helped, but that vitamin D levels in the 60 to 70 nanogram per deciliter range seems to be the final piece that really pulls everything together and kind of cools the autoimmune fires. So, you know, Lauren Cordain, we did a call out for folks who had been diagnosed with autoimmune disease, went paleo, and then had follow-up blood work, and for either good or ill. And we had a huge response to this, and we had over 100 people with verifiable blood work, you know, pre-paleo, known autoimmune disease, lupus, multiple sclerosis, you know, whatever, started eating autoimmune paleo. Subsequent blood work showed resolution of the autoimmune antibodies and the fact that the person felt a ton better. So it just seems like really fair game to give it a shot, because at the end of the day, we're asking folks to eat, you know, meat, fruit, veggies, good fats, something that would generally be healthy anyway, and then we might pull out, you know, the grains, legumes, dairy, nightshades perhaps, whatever the offending item or items are, and we might be able to put the condition into remission. So it seems like a reasonably safe thing to give it a shot. I did not get feedback from the person that was on the or submitted the question before, so I don't know if it is of benefit for this particular condition. It would be really interesting to get some feedback from folks if they're doing autoimmune protocol for this and whether it works or not.
All right. Okay. Extended breastfeeding and fat loss. Amazon woman says, "Hi, Greg and Rob. I have a question about the effects of extended breastfeeding and the associated hormone levels on fat loss. I'm a 36-year-old mother of five who is 5'11", broad shoulders, with Viking ancestry. Clearly. My youngest is 15 months old. I started eating low-carb or paleo/primal and doing CrossFit about a year ago. I worked my way up to 3 to 4 WODs plus 2 Olympic lifting classes and 1 to 2 sprinting sessions per week and lost an initial 30 pounds. I felt great. But about 7 months ago, the scale stalled out and hasn't changed since then. I know the scale is rather unreliable, but I really want to lose the butt, hip, thigh fat that seems to be stubbornly hanging on. I thought maybe I was overdoing the WODs, and since it's the Olympic lifting that I really love, I went down to 1 WOD a week, but left. I feel like such a dork saying that word. I just have to say this.
Why don't you just say workout?
but left the other workouts the same. So now I have about 5 varied workouts a week. I also eliminated the several times a week glass of wine, which I felt was the last dietary issue I had. Mike's over here laughing because we just had this discussion yesterday. But I was only drinking 1 bottle of red wine a night. But still, the butt, hips, thighs remain the same. Now I've always breastfed my babies till the ages of 2 or 3, which works for us, and this has always kept my fertility/periods away till about 2 years. I'm wondering if the hormonal effects of breastfeeding that results in amenorrhea, no periods, would be enough to prevent my body from letting go of that extra fat, despite my very clean diet and weightlifting. I'm certainly not willing to wean my son so that I can look better naked, but it would be reassuring to know that it's probably hormones working against me. Rather than that, I'm just not doing other stuff right. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Amazon woman, mama to 5, ages 12 to 1.
Nice.
Interesting order of ages there. I would have said 1 to 12.
Yeah. It's like saying counting backwards, I guess.
It's awkward.
Yeah. you know, it's interesting. I think for most women, when they do a concerted effort at breastfeeding postpartum, I think that it actually accentuates fat loss because you're just burning through calories, producing the breast milk and all that sort of stuff. I'm just kind of wondering if, you know, what your baseline was before going into this. Like, were you quite lean before going into this? I know for Nikki, like, historically, she's run around like a size 2. Like, she's really strong, pretty muscular, just skinny legs, skinny butt, the whole deal. And then obviously she gained some weight through the process of being pregnant, and it's been remarkably slow coming off. Like, she leaned out initially a pretty good whack, but she's several, you know, pant sizes bigger than what she would normally walk around at and still breastfeeding. And I know initially, like, she was getting horrible sleep for the first probably 4 months, and then it's gotten a little bit better now. And it's interesting, as her sleep has improved, she's definitely leaned out through the belly, like that kind of cortisol insulin resistant deal right under the belly button and everything. But you know, she's quite a ways off of where she was previously, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's some hormonal tweaking that occurs that helps keep enough of a fat mass to keep the breastfeeding a little bit more dialed in. I have heard that, you know, with multiple kids, the leaning out process can get a little bit more challenging as well. And it looks like you're working. This was number five. So, you know, that could definitely be a little bit of an issue too, but I'm thinking about like sleep, you know, stress, all the kids.
How do you sleep with five kids in a house?
Dude, I probably like
have
either
one and it's tough. One and a half, a child and a dog. So,
and a dog, yeah, the dog is significant. So, I did. Those are my thoughts on it. Like, I would not see any problem with the idea that the hormonal status of breastfeeding could maybe stymie that last really significant chunk of fat loss. That totally makes sense. But I'm also wondering, you know, what about sleep? What about stress and all that sort of jive? And what was your level that you were starting from? I'm assuming that you're using a trying to get back to a baseline that you were at right before this. And if that was really significantly lean, then it may just take some time and post-weaning to really get back to that spot.
Cool. Well, that's it.
Sweet. So what do you and Mighty Mike got hooked up for the day?
I got to wrap up some programming for next week, and then just going to get things set up for the meet tomorrow, and definitely need to get some food. I'm feeling skinny.
Food would be good.
Feeling skinny
food
and weak.
Food would be good.
So,
dude, story of my life.
I'm feeling very ectomorphic right now.
Well, let's wrap this thing up so that we can lift weights and eat food to forestall that. So
mesify myself.
Indeed. Bob Takano book out. Your programming ebook is out.
Olympic Weightlifting for Sports, my new book, is out as an ebook now also from our site.
Nice.
So you digital folks can get that now.
Sweet.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, same time next week, we'll find you somewhere around here.
We'll make it work one way or the other.
Right on. Thanks, G.
All right. See ya.
Bye.